Good morning, and thank you very much for being here today. Let me acknowledge, first of all, that this Professor Oderson, Sivani Vasquez, and Dr. Powers are members of this study. So antibiotics are probably one of the greatest single medical success of the 20th century, made possible the control of natural infections and interventional medicine, and facilitated the development of the pharmaceutical industry as we know today. Major health authorities agree that antibiotics resistance is one of the most pressing public health concerns. It's a concern worldwide, and the gains in life expectancy can be jeopardized because of the resistance of microbes, resistance to drugs. So having that in mind, the objectives of this research were to describe antimicrobial new molecular entities and new therapeutic biologics approved by the FDA from 1980 to 2009, and assess differences among therapeutic classes in characteristics of the new molecular entities and BLAST approved by the FDA in the study period. The data we used for the analysis were drugs approved with therapeutic equivalence evaluations, Orange Book versions from the 80s to 2009, and the drugs that FDA database. We updated the data through December 31st, 2009. We included data at the first and second ATC level in the analysis. We performed trends analysis and assessed differences between groups using the chi-square test. The significance level was set at the 0.05. So one of the first results of this study, we found that, as you can see in this chart, from the 80s to 2000, this has been a reduction in the number of anti-infectives approved as a percentage of the total approvals by the FDA, from 24% to a little bit less than 18 to less than 15%. It's worth mentioning that when we talk about anti-infectives, we have the major groups in terms of anti-infectives are antibacterials and HIV antiretrovirals, but we also have other anti-infectives included in other ATC categories. You can see, for example, some of them in the dermatological group or the genitourinary system. So focusing on antibacterials for systemic use, as I mentioned before, there's been a reduction in the number of FDA approvals from 29 to 23 to 9. Also, a reduction, always a percentage of the number of approvals, have been the antibacterials, new molecular entities that has been marketed. And even a lower percentage, the number of those that use the priority review process. When we compare with all other ATC categories, excluding systemic antibacterials, we see different trends. The increase in the number of approvals in all other ATC categories, the products marketed, and still a percentage of those products use their priority review process. Now, when we put all of them together, we have in this chart just selected therapeutic classes. You can see cardiovascular, antibacterials, nervous system, cancer products, and HIV antiretrovirals. And you're going to see the shift in the trends from the 80s to the 90s to 2000s. And as I mentioned, the shift from the antibacterials and cardiovascular products reduction to an increase in the cancer products and HIV antiretrovirals products. So when we compare systemic antibacterials versus other therapeutic classes in the period of analysis, we found that only 8.3% were systemic antibacterials, new molecular entities out of the 739 new molecular entities approved by the FDA, no BLAST in the systemic antibacterials category. 27% were priority review versus 44% for other therapeutic classes, and no orphan drugs for antibacterials versus 22% for all other classes. We also analyzed the issue of discontinuations of new molecular entities and BLAST approved from the 80s to 1999. And as you see, it's been around 50% of the antibacterials for systemic use were discontinued from the market, followed by antiparasitic and hormonal preparations, et cetera. Cardiovascular products are a little less than 20%. Respiratory system, 16%, et cetera. In terms of the discussion, we tend to focus on issues related with antibacterials innovation, just focusing on new products, new molecular entities. Nevertheless, we have to keep in mind that antibacterial innovation could be also by the side of the new combinations, new indications, and new formulations, not only new products, vaccines, medical devices, and changes in procedures, medical guidelines, and improving protocols, particularly related with utilization of antibiotics and infection controls. So the bottom line is that antibacterial innovation is not only related with funding new drugs, new antibiotics in this case. In terms of incentives for research and development, we found a large number of new molecular entities in the cancer and HIV products. And some of the reasons behind this could be the inadequate treatments we have available, a higher risk-benefit ratio, incentives for R&D in these categories, particularly NIH funding, and orphan drug status, 7 years of market exclusivity, and special financing systems for these products. As I mentioned before, it is a very important issue related with antibacterials conservation of these products. So more resources could be devoted to antibiotic conservation. Public sector reimbursement systems have a huge impact in terms of antibiotic utilization, overutilization, and misutilization. And the FDA doesn't have a well-defined regulatory role related with antibiotic conservation. So to conclude, in terms of the FDA approvals and discontinuations varied by therapeutic class in the study period, classes with large number of patients, cardiovascular products, and antibiotics decreased as a percentage of the total FDA approvals, and approvals in other classes, particularly antiretrovirals and cancer products, increased. Differences in approvals occur in the speed of all drugs included in the analysis having the same patent and exclusivity regulation in place, even for antibiotics after 1997. Some of the reasons that could explain these trends are the status of the science and technology, the availability and characteristics of the products we have in the market, as I mentioned before, the higher risk-benefit ratio for antiretrovirals and cancer products, reimbursement system, Medicare and Medicaid playing a huge role, and commercial and R&D strategies by the pharmaceutical companies. To conclude, it's important to consider the need for conservation programs. The implementation of antibiotic conservation programs could be critical given the reduction in new approvals, new antibiotic approvals, their high market discontinuation rate, and the development of resistance. This project was funded by the Robert Good Johnson Foundation, and we don't have any financial relation on any other to disclose. Thank you very much.
It doesn't look like we're getting thrown out of here, so may I invite our panelists up to the table here, and any questions, and again, thank each of you for excellent presentations of very important topics, and I'm sure people have questions or queries.
Your Your study's interesting, but in a number of the countries that you looked at, while there's not direct consumer advertising in the sense that the U.S. has it, there are product awareness ads that are aired, at least in Canada and Australia, probably in a number of other countries, and that might be much more of a factor in increasing awareness than what's on the internet.
That's true. We haven't looked into that, and that is really good.
My question is
more
to
sure.
Your
staff
setting. I guess my question is, what exactly is wrong with individuals being able to get educated on certain medications?
Sure. It's never stated that it's wrong. I think it's the fact that it is illegal, and we're just looking at what kind of avenues people are gathering their information. But never, and I apologize if I kind of portrayed this, but never had the intention of saying that it was wrong.
So what are your suggestions that if a pharmaceutical company has their website, mm-hmm. that somebody in another country, if they went to it would be blocked or somehow be blocked? Like,
oh no, not at all. We're just curious as to how people may be able to gather direct-to-consumer drug advertisements from other countries, although it is prohibited. We were just wondering what kind of avenues are available, and this gentleman over here informed us that there are public announcements.
Is there any third-party avenues available from the countries? What if we go to WebMD? Is there any third-party type stuff, not directly from a pharmaceutical company, available for them to go to?
Oh, I'm sure.
Okay.
I'm sure. And then there's also there are the public announcements, and then media plays a huge role, and again, movies, it's really prevalent there as well.
So just to follow up, Peter, in the stuff that you found on the web that's broadly available, is there the same kind of balancing of risk to benefit and message, and that might be what we call thematic in using web-based advertising, and there's not the same kind of risk information that's carried along as is required.
From what we saw internationally?
Yes.
They were the same exact website, same exact information.
Okay, so they do in fact carry the risk information.
Yeah, it was everything. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question for Vanessa on Medicare Part D. You're dealing with a lot of high percentage of individuals who are eligible for the LIS, so cost sharing and co-payments don't matter that much to them. Is that why you think a lot of people didn't sign up for the lowest cost plan? And another question I have for you is, what about the star ratings? Did anybody pay attention to that at all?
What we would do, we would give people the three plans that had the lowest costs and printed out and had the star ratings there. I never saw anybody pay attention to anything but the cost. They just didn't care. There's a way to input the pharmacy.
Pay attention to the cost, did you say?
They only paid attention to cost. There was a way to put in the pharmacy they get their medications from to make sure that those plans covered drugs at those pharmacies. So that was a big thing for patients. But the star plans, I mean, if you've seen them, it's really three, four, five. I mean, it's very minimal. And then for the Part D patients, a lot of them, I mean, most of these patients were automatically assigned into a benchmark plan. So the chances that they were paying, you know, thousands and thousands above were pretty low. But we still did find some, as you saw, the one that was 25,000 had selected the same plan as his spouse to make it easier and had gone outside the benchmark. So he was paying a premium and full cost for his medications. So for the most part, people's chances of having really extreme cost variances were low. But of the patients, when you presented it to them, I mean, you saw that one of the patients could save $2 and jumped on it. I mean, in these populations, every little bit counts. So a 68% decrease seemed significant to most of the patients that we saw.
What was the
Medicaid? So 85% were full or partial LAS at the beginning. So I think that broke down to 79% full duals and then 6 partial LAS.
Yes, I have a question for Gabriel. Do we have any idea of how important is the problem of content fit in the US? In other countries, they say maybe it's 20%.
Yeah.
It seems like most of the information we have is related to problems of manufacturing, but in the US, for some reason, all the violation letters provided by the FDA, but we have less information about these international problems other than these cases.
It's a really good point. First, let me say that the data on prevalence of counterfeit drugs or substandard medication that haven't been made under quality standards is really scarce. There haven't been a lot of broad studies, and as the gentleman points out, studies that have been done have mainly been done in developing and emerging economies, and prevalences in some studies have shown to be quite high. Up 20, 30, even 40, in some smaller studies, up to 50% of products surveyed have been shown to be either counterfeit or substandard. Less data for Western world, particularly the US, their numbers out there floating around suggest less than 1% of products here are substandard or counterfeit. Really, these are estimates. No one has a good sense of the actual effect on the US market. But it's also important to note that there is a serious issue of substandard medication in the developing world context, particularly with antiretrovirals and other anti-infectives, which are obviously in great need in those contexts as well.
This gets at two of your points. Is there, do you have any data, maybe you could point some studies that may be ongoing about counterfeit medicine sold online? To the point of these websites, these are the legitimate websites, but there's a vast majority of, you know, 30,000 some estimates say, illegitimate websites posing as pharmacies selling kind of substandard misbranded medication.
This is a really difficult subject as well. We've one topic that I didn't really get into was issues of pharmaceutical distribution and the way in which a counterfeit finished drug can make its way into the distribution system. There's sort of a lot of aspects to that, but as you point out, there's a lot of increased use of internet pharmacies, and patients are increasingly looking to find affordable pharmaceuticals from internet pharmacies, and sometimes these pharmacies are operating outside of the US, which touches on another issue of reimportation of pharmaceuticals, so it gets quite complicated quite quickly. We haven't looked at that internet pharmacy specifically intensively. There was one study by Roger Bate at the American Enterprise Institute, perhaps you know it. He was looking just at brand products, not generic products, and he found that there was risk associated with sites that were not accredited by the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. He used another accreditation agency as well, which was a pharmacy checker, and I think they looked at sites that were based outside the US as well. It's clearly a wide range of quality of these sites, and there's a large possibility for risk, but it's not something we have a lot of quantitative data on.
You mentioned being able to create patents. That's kind of an important aspect of population growth and maintaining affordable access to medicine. I was wondering if you could just touch a little bit more on that. And also, you mentioned that there's been an interesting recent infectious disease that that has or does not have.
Okay, so each of these countries had different timelines for actually implementing patents on branding products. Once the patent is put into place, once the country actually puts the system in place, then they cannot go ahead and bring patents and start making generics on their own. However, the way it worked in the World Trade Organization was that any patents that were broken prior to actually implementing it in that country, they were allowed to continue making it. The patent breaking is a huge problem because, again, each brand maker either demands significant royalties if they license it out to manufacture to other countries, or if they're manufacturing it themselves and they're selling it, then they're actually charging way more than what the average population can actually afford. Compulsory licensing, which I was mentioning, is actually a legal way to break patents under the World Trade Organization. That's a whole another issue that we're actually looking at. The one example I can give you is Thailand, which has broken patents on arms in the past. Compulsory licensing, it's a nice way of saying that, sure, you know, you can go ahead and manufacture your drug or buy it from another generics manufacturer in another country. The problem with that, though, is the Western world is very hard on countries that break patents, even if they use compulsory licensing. Thailand got put on the U.S. Trade Representative's red list, which is a significant thing for any developing country. And so the repercussions in terms of breaking patents are actually very severe for most of those countries. Again, India, China, Thailand, Brazil, any of these countries at any point can actually break patents, saying that they have an epidemic, because what an epidemic is, what incidence is required, what prevalence is required is not defined under the provision. So any country can actually go ahead and say we have an epidemic and go ahead and legally break the patent. But they have to weigh in the risks of actually breaking their patent, and they're very reluctant to do that. So the only one that we know so far is this one. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask one more quick question about that parking presentation? The fact that you were able to get out-of-pocket savings for LIS kind of indicates that you probably have a lot of choosers. Did you have any opportunities to ask any of them what had driven them? I know that's something that MedPAC is looking at now, but I didn't know if you had any chance to actually speak to them about what led them to decide to stay in a plan that has higher premium as benchmark.
So choosers were actually a very small percentage of our population. And you have to understand, when they do the benchmark random assignments, it doesn't take into account any of the medications the patient's actually taking. So it's just, you get this, you get that, and then, you know, hope it all works out. And so the fact that each plan has different formularies could mean that patients end up in plans that cover none of their drugs, or it could mean that they cover all of them. So primarily, most of the drugs the patients are taking are generic. But for whatever reason, if they have to take a brand name drug and it's not on the formulary, that could represent a huge opportunity for cost savings just by switching a plan.
So they're staying in plans where their drugs aren't covered?
Yes, because they don't know. Because, again, the only way to tell is by the Plan Finder online tool. So that's why we were using that.
Can I just jump in quickly on that point? I've been involved with Part B implementation at two separate universities. And talking to patients, I've also interviewed patients for my own dissertation. One of the biggest problems with LIS is the cycle on and off eligibility for the Part LIS subsidiaries, not the full dual benefits. And so at any point during the year, if they cycle off their benefit, they're actually, it doesn't matter if they're in the donut hole, they're out of the donut hole, whatever that is, they're just not going to have that access to the medications. So that's one of the biggest problematics for the dual, not the dual, sorry, the LIS eligible in my opinion. So I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems.
Other questions?